It is Monday, June the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. takes out Syrian jet.
This is not surprising, given the different sets of forces in such close proximity to each other.
Also ahead, investigation into alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
We are in this period now where Congress and the public investigations going on in the House and Senate have not been able to directly tie President Trump to any malfeasance vis-a-vis Russia.
Bodies recovered from a U.S. Navy ship, plus the musical genius of two cellos. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A U.S. warplane has shot down a Russian-made Syrian army jet, with Washington saying the jet had dropped bombs near U.S.-backed forces, and Damascus saying the plane was down while flying a mission against the Islamic State militants. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Trinity University Middle East scholar David Lesh for his read on all of this.
This is worrisome. You don't know if this is just a product of the Islamic State shrinking and forces getting in closer proximity to one another, or is this one side or the other taking it up a notch in terms of trying to stake out their territory and inevitably coming into conflict with other parties in the conflict zone.
The Defense Department statement said that they did contact their Russian counterparts by phone via an established deconfliction line to de-escalate the situation. The coalition, it said, does not seek to fight the Syrian regime, Russian or pro-regime forces, but will not hesitate to defend itself or its partnered forces from any threat.
Certainly the U.S. government and its forces do not want to escalate the conflict against Russia, against the Syrian government, against Iranians or their allied forces. You know, this is not the focus of the fight in Syria for the U.S. It's ISIS. So whenever something like this happens, as happened in the last couple of weeks with the conflict in the southeast near Tunis, immediately afterward, the U.S. government said the very same thing. We do not seek out a conflict with the Syrian regime or its allies, but they will defend themselves. So they're very consistent in that regard, but I think they're very much trying, for good reason, not to escalate the situation into a conflict with the Syrian government and certainly not Russia.
The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the Syrian army Sunday advanced into the northern province of Raqqa as part of an offensive to reach the neighboring oil-rich province of Deir ez-Zor. Of course, that is a strong rebel outpost, is it not?
Well, it is. In Deir ez-Zor, there's an Islamic State presence. There has been a Syrian government outpost present in Deir ez-Zor since the beginning of the war. But this is, everyone, it seems to be, particularly on the Syrian government side, racing out to extend as much control as possible as the Islamic State shrinks. Again, with all these different sets of forces in the area, particularly around Raqqa right now, the question is, what will happen to Raqqa once the Islamic State is pushed out, as it appears that it inevitably will be. And, of course, we have to consider Turkey into this equation, because they don't want to see the Syrian Democratic Forces that are mostly made up by Kurds, who the Turks consider to be terrorists, to take over Raqqa and perhaps extend the Kurdish presence into Syria further than what it already is. So this is a very, very complicated theater of war that it's militarily complicated and will, once the military objectives, the immediate military objectives are achieved, will become even more diplomatically complicated.
Syrian and allied militia forces apparently met up with Iraqi forces at the Al-Walid border crossing for the first time in years. What do you make of that?
Well, it seems that Iran, wants this land bridge from Iran through Iraq and Syria all the way to Lebanon. At least that's what U.S. Forces and allied forces fear, and certainly Israel also fears this. So the action in the south may be a function of jostling for a position, but clearly it seems that the U.S. and its allied forces were taken a little bit off guard at the alacrity and intensity of the Syrian government and pro-government forces in their desire to perhaps establish control along the borders in order to establish this land bridge.
Of course, it appears obviously that the Islamic State is on the back foot right now, but looking at this complicated map of Syria, where does this all head, do you think?
Well, I think it's heading towards spheres of influence. You have a Turkish sphere, and in fact, many Syrians will say that some parts of northern Turkey, northern Syria, have essentially become part of Turkey in all but name. You have Iranian influence. Of course, you have U.S.-backed forces. You have Kurdish forces. And then you have Syrian government-controlled areas, certainly along most of the main cities in the western part of the country and along the coast. This all has to be figured out in the inevitable aftermath of the at least the most intense part of the civil war. Will it be done diplomatically, or will it just be a prelude to more conflict within Syria, supported by different proxy groups? And this is why, setting the stage for at least some sort of political settlement and a vision for the future that can account for what, in essence, already exists in Syria, and that is decentralization. The question always is, how much power is the Syrian government willing to give up in order to keep Syria whole, where, in effect, there may be areas that are semi-independent, a la what happened in Iraq following the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. So, a lot has left to be decided, and clearly, when the Islamic State is reduced, at least as a territorial entity, there still may be more conflict to come. And although the initial war may be over, the conflict, diplomatic, political, and otherwise, may begin.
David Lesh is the Ewing Hassell Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University. He also is an author, including the book Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Dr. Lesh spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Probes into Russian connections to the recent U.S. presidential election, questions of obstruction of justice, and the shooting of a prominent Republican member of Congress have all played into political tensions in Washington in the last week. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells VOA's Jim Stevenson that barring any major revelation this week, it will likely be relatively quiet.
Jim, this was a tragedy, and it was something that no one expected at a charity game where Democrats and Republicans, members of Congress, all join on the same baseball field for a friendly game to benefit charity. It has caused a certain reassessment of the security measures here in Washington for members of Congress and more broadly at a time of, I suppose, extreme rancor, not just in Washington, but across the nation. It did spark, at least for a day or two, a sense among lawmakers of both parties that there is something more important than the partisan squabbling that goes on a daily basis, that we are all Americans. I have my doubts as to how long those conciliatory sentiments and warm, fuzzy expressions will last. This is a political town, and we are in a hyper-partisan political atmosphere, not the least of which has to do with this ongoing investigation of President Donald Trump. And Jim, for the first week in several weeks, we do not have a marquee witness coming before Congress to tell all as to what he or she knows. Jay Johnson, who was the Homeland Security chief under President Obama, is going to be testifying. And there are some noises among Republicans that they might like President Obama's Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, to come and testify. But we do seem to be in a little bit of a lull, and that lull has been taken up by the president's own tweets, as is his wont.
Donald Trump always saying what is on his mind via Twitter, and sometimes that has stirred up more problems for him than perhaps benefits in jabbing his opposition.
Here we are in this atmosphere. You had the president's legal team saying that the president was not under investigation. You had James Comey saying that as far as he knew before he was fired as FBI director last month, that Donald Trump was not personally under investigation in connection with the Russia probe. But there were reports that came out that perhaps Special Counsel Robert Mueller is looking into the president, not from the question of whether there was any collusion with the Russians, but whether, in fact, he obstructed justice. And, in fact, Donald Trump took to Twitter just a couple of days ago and himself said, I am being investigated by the FBI. This was not helpful, I would suppose, for the contentions of his legal team. But we are in this period now where Congress and, as far as I can tell, the public investigations going on in the House and Senate have not been able to directly tie President Trump to any malfeasance vis-a-vis Russia. So the question becomes, what might have transpired between him and James Comey? James Comey had his side of the story in terms of pressure coming from the president to squash one facet of the Russia investigation, pressure to publicly affirm that the president is not under investigation, and then, of course, his very abrupt firing. Does that constitute an obstruction of justice? From what we are hearing from those close to the investigation who are leaking to the news media, it does appear that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is looking into it.
Washington will continue to grind through the process of sorting this out, and we will continue to watch as Michael Bowman at his perch in the Senate, our VOA correspondent there. Thank you so much, Michael.
Always a pleasure.
And many thanks to you, gentlemen. Also in the news, the U.S. Navy has called off its search for seven missing sailors after finding bodies in the sleeping compartments of the USS Fitzgerald. That's the Navy destroyer that collided with a massive merchant vessel off the coast of Japan early on Saturday. Vice Admiral Joseph Aucoin is commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet based in Tokyo.
We have transferred the remains to the Yokosuka Naval Hospital. The families are being notified and are being provided the support that they all need at this difficult time. Please keep them in your thoughts and prayers.
There was no immediate explanation of that collision. VOA asked Ralph Kosa, president of the Pacific Forum of CSIS in Honolulu, if the waters where the collision took place might have contributed to the incident.
I mean, this is a very busy waterway, which is why people are always supposed to be quite vigilant in watching out when they're operating. Now the big cargo ship, whatever it was, that collided with it, probably doesn't have the kind of capabilities for monitoring and surveillance that the destroyer does. So you would have expected that any warning would have come from the U.S. Navy ship and not from the other.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sent a sympathy message to President Trump over the sailors' deaths, and Admiral Aucoin thanked the Japanese for their help.
I really would like to express my heartfelt thanks to our Japanese allies, particularly the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, with their tremendous support. They are with us the whole time, and they really helped us out a lot.
Aucoin said the Navy will launch an investigation into that collision so the families and the Navy altogether will know what happened. Now, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, also referred to as Obamacare. Senate Republicans are trying to find enough votes for their updated version of that health care bill. George Mason University health economist and director of health policy and research Lynn Nichols explains to International Edition's Lori London why the issue of health care in the U.S. is so divisive.
What this really is fitting a debate about government into a prism of health policy. They want less government. They want lower taxes. They want the government role to be less intrusive in insurance markets. And you can't cover people without all of that. So they've rejected the philosophy of the ACA. When they got pushback from various folks, particularly in the town halls, about what this really means for them, some of whom, obviously, are their constituents, they came back and huddled and said, okay, well, we'll do these cosmetic things and hope that'll work. But CBO did its job and says, no, those little band-aids don't work at all.
What are you referring to that the report says regarding Americans' health care and what this bill, if it were passed in the Senate in its current form, what it would do?
Specifically, members of Congress and the president promised that people with pre-existing health conditions would be able to buy affordable health insurance just like they can now with the Affordable Care Act. In fact, the president promised it would be cheaper than it is now. This bill would do, as it passed the House, is make it a heck of a lot more expensive for people with pre-existing conditions and, in many cases, make it impossible for them to buy, which is exactly why CBO said the number of uninsured would rise so much.
Why would it make it impossible?
They're saying to states, you can choose to waive the requirement that insurers have to sell to everyone. You can waive the requirement that insurers have to cover all benefits, which enables them to end the annual limits and lifetime limits, which are a lifeline for people who have cancer and serious health conditions. And by waiving all those rules, you would drive the premium way up and indeed make it unaffordable for a whole bunch of people. Plus, the switch from income-based subsidies to age-based subsidies, in conjunction with age rating being made much more favorable to insurance companies, means that people in their 40s and 50s and early 60s before they get on Medicare would be paying, in some cases, I'm not making this up, 800% more than they're paying now under the ACA. In fact, it's set up to say what we want to do is make health insurance cheaper for the healthy and for the high income, and make health insurance more expensive for the unhealthy and the low income. And that's all done in the name of reducing the role of government, but it's going to cause real harm to real people.
House Speaker Paul Ryan said that it's just giving people an option, but the prices are 800 times higher. Doesn't sound like they would have that option.
We all have choices to live under a bridge, but isn't it interesting only the poor choose to do so? His definition of choice is that government does not compel purchase and government does not supply enough funds to make it easy to purchase. So, yeah, there's a choice here, but it's quite an extreme choice.
This healthcare debate has been going on for so many years. People didn't like Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Now it's more popular than ever. People are worried about losing their insurance. It clearly has insured millions more people than before we had it. What's the choice here? What do we do? I mean, there are problems with it, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And serious people, I think, would be quite happy to sit in a room and try to fix those problems. And I think you're going to see Democrats in the Senate, and frankly, there are Republicans in the Senate who have indicated they're willing to work with Democrats. But first, the Republicans have to put down their lies about Obamacare being a disaster, and Democrats have to admit that there are people who got hurt by the Affordable Care Act that they didn't intend to hurt. And those are people who are relatively modest income but didn't qualify for a subsidy, who had their premiums go up because they were buying cheap policies in a heavily underwritten individual market before. So there's a way to fix all this, and they're working on it, I believe, behind closed doors, but it takes leadership. But the reason this debate goes on and the reason we're in this situation is that there are some people who have, I would say, deluded themselves into believing that health insurance and risk pooling is actually socialism. It is not socialism to take care of people who are in your country. It is not socialism to make sure that if you're unlucky, you will be able to get the health care you need. It is not socialism to make sure that people can get the health care they need so they can grow up and they can learn what they need to learn and get productive and work in the labor market and be productive citizens.
George Mason University health economist Lynn Nichols speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published online in the journal Preventative Medicine finds children and teenagers are less physically active than previously thought. The paper also shows the only increase in activity are among young adults over age 20 to about 35. From that point through midlife and into older adulthood, the researchers from the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health say that they found physical activity levels steadily declined. To make their findings, the researchers used activity trackers to study the daily physical movements of more than 12,000 participants. The study authors say that while they found alarmingly low activity levels among those at the end of adolescence, by the time they turned 19, however, their physical activity dropped to levels comparable to 60-year-olds. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, we'll meet two of the more popular instrumentalists in the business. Luka Shulich and Stepan Hauser, better known as Two Cellos. They met while in master's class in Zagreb while they were still teenagers. Classically trained cellists have been performing as Two Cellos since before 2010, playing both classical music and covers of some of the hottest rock and roll songs ever to top the charts. Not long ago, they were part of Elton John's band. He says some friends told him to check them out on YouTube.
And I said on the spot, oh my God, this is incredible. I've never seen cello players play like this. I've never seen cello players rock out. And I said, God, I've got to have them in my band straight away.
Elton John also talked about the synergy between the two cellists.
I absolutely love these guys. The way they play together, if you go and check it out on YouTube and you not only see the rock music that they play, but also the classical music they play, they're in sync. It's like Bernie Taupin and myself. He writes lyrics, I write melodies. I don't know why it works, but it works. With these two guys, they just play so beautifully together. They seem to know what either one of them is going to do at the next moment. And that musically is a gift. It doesn't happen very often. The spontaneity that they have is incredible, and they seem to have it together.
The duo perform internationally, and they're touring right now all over the world, where their cover of Voodoo People by The Prodigy is always on the playlist. So far this year, Shulich and Hauser have released a new album. It's called Score, which was recorded with the London Symphony and includes a wide array of television and film music. They're always asked to play Carl Jenkins' composition, Benedictus, from the Mass for Peace.
Thank you.
You know, they're quite amazing. Stepan and Luka, two guys from Croatia and Slovenia, and they've taken the world by storm. We'd like to thank everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. The top world news is straight ahead, and we hope that you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now, a bit more from Two Cellos and Benedictus.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The six-month campaign by the Iraqi army to take back the city of Mosul from ISIS is coming to an end. The terrorist group captured Mosul and looked toward capturing Baghdad itself, but has since lost most of Mosul to Iraq's armed forces and is clinging to a handful of pockets within the far western reaches of the city. It is now just a matter of time before the last ISIS extremists are killed or chased from the city. But as they prepare for a last stand, the terrorists are ever more brutal in their treatment of Mosul's civilian population. According to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, ISIS has killed over 200 people in the last 3 weeks. Entire families, including children, have been murdered by the terrorists. Zaid Ra'ad al-Hussein, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, said shooting children as they try to run to safety with their families. Really, there are no words of condemnation strong enough. Clearly, these amount to war crimes. ISIS has used human shields in the past and killed people who have tried to leave the city, but now the slaughter and other abuses are escalating. ISIS is locking entire families in basements with no food or water and welding the doors shut and booby-trapping streets and houses with explosives to prevent people from leaving. So we are working very closely with Iraqi security forces on the plan to ensure that we defeat the remaining fighters in Mosul, while also doing our utmost to protect the civilian life that Daesh is so aggressively trying to take, said Special Presidential Envoy Brett McGurk. But it's a really important reminder of what's happening right now, of the true face of this enemy. They are mass murderers. They are barbaric. They are a threat to all civilization, all humanity, and those civilians in Mosul trapped, being held hostage by ISIS, we will do everything we can in supporting the Iraqi security forces to free them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.